Hello, everybody. Welcome to Fortified 45's episode number 3. I'm your host, Mr. Pierre. Welcome all, and I hope you're all feeling fine and dandy as I am. Ish. So I'm sat here on the banks of the River Lee. Well, actually, I'm in the collapse heap. I've had my first form of exercise in 6 months after I completed, not very gracefully, the London Marathon. Now, while my bruised ego continues to tell me that it was a pretty experience, my guest, however, gave me an inspiring perspective, as she did with many other subjects discussed in this episode. Now, Lebu Dzeko, you better pronounce that right, who's known for her quick thinking and decision making, let's say had some difficulty whittling down her 45-45s. Therefore, I had to split the podcast into two parts. Part one discusses her formative years, the influence of jazz in South Africa, and also her early correspondence with famous pop stars. Part two delves more into her professional career, where she famously got locked in the Capitol building where the pro-Trump supporters stormed in back in January 2021. Cheekiness aside, we had a great long conversation, which I had to split into two parts just to make sure you guys got everything that we discussed. So without further ado, let's get into episode 3 of Fortified 45s. 45. 45. Hi, Lebo. Welcome to 45 45s. How are you?
Lebo. Lebo. Imagine it with a U.
Great start.
Imagine Lebo. Lebo. That's it. Lebo. Not French, but like Lebo. It's short for Kia Lebo. So Lebo is the short of it.
Great start. Got it right. But I'm not going to try and pronounce it perfectly.
Go on. Go on.
Lebo.
I like the French you find. Lebo. Lebo and Pierre.
I'm going to go. But how have you been anyway, besides me pronouncing your name badly?
Good.
Where have you been? I can't keep up with you. Brazil, right?
Yes, I've just come back from Brazil. It was amazing. We were talking to black and brown women who are going to basically decide who runs the country in October. So I'm excited about that. That's a documentary that's coming out. And then I'm off to South Africa for a month to report, to do some corresponding on Monday. So,
well, I look forward to your documentary to check that out. When's it coming out? When's it due to be aired?
In the middle of May. So
excellent. I'll look forward to that. Yeah. Now, how did we meet? Now, what I can remember is we met with Run DMC Crew, being up to Charlie Dark.
Yeah.
I remember meeting you, obviously, we ran together. First of all, do you still run? Do you still?
Yeah, I am. I've been training for a marathon at the moment. The pandemic really took my running discipline out of me. Yep. I did run, but not the sorts of distances that I had been doing before. But yeah.
Are you going to divulge which marathon you are going to
do? It's Richmond. It's not a fancy foreign trip, but that's when I come back from South Africa. I'll
Brilliant. So. Yeah. When you said about the pandemic taking toll, so you know I did the London Marathon badly. It started and stopped.
Can we rephrase that? How many people have completed the London Marathon? How many people have done a marathon?
Liberal, so, thank you very much. It was
I also was broken when I did the London Marathon. In fact, I was injured afterwards. But it was an amazing experience. I bet you thought it was an amazing experience.
Okay. I was ill. I had a bit of a man flu. You probably thought it was, but I had a man flu and I shouldn't really have run because, it could take your energy out of it. But I built up all this, support. I was doing it for Grenfell and changing faces. I wasn't going to give up and do that then. And then I was losing my energy. And then I think towards the end, I was just struggling, man. I wasn't enjoying it. And I didn't want to be like running with the road sweepers right behind me. Do you know what I mean? I just wanted to get there, but it wasn't getting that bad, but I did enjoy it eventually. In retrospect, I'm glad I did it, but it wasn't pretty towards the end. I'm not going to lie. It was really difficult. So congratulations on doing your marathon again.
Yeah. Well, that is marathons. I've cried in marathons.
Wow.
I've been elated in marathons, but I find running a really good, it's something that I use a lot in life.
Yeah.
Like, the ups and downs, the kind of pushing through stuff, also some of the techniques you use for running as well. I apply them. I use them for my life.
So really
I think it's a really good teacher. Yeah. And I think it's just in terms of life lessons and also kind of strategies for life as well.
Yeah. I'm glad you look at it like that. I mean, I haven't run since the marathon and I really need to get back on it. I thought I've done it now. I just rest on my laurels, but I do find it cathartic. And you got some time and to think, and you think I can think creatively. And you're just running, you can switch off. And yeah, I'm talking myself back into running, aren't I, really? So
yes.
So back to how we met, Random Crew, big up to Charlie Dark. What can I say about meeting you? Was amazing. You know, you welcomed me to the group really well. But when I was just observing other people and watching the large group of people who used to meet at the Ace Hotel, and I observed you, I wasn't observing you, like, but you just held your own. I'm going to embarrass you now, but you're quite stately. You hold your own. You're quite regal. You just like preside sometimes. Do you know what I mean? You just chill and just like hold your own. You're quite self assured, I think. I mean, you look at me strangely, but that's the impression I got from you as well. You don't stand for any rubbish as well.
Well, yeah, it's always interesting how other people see you. I think one of the things I loved about Run Them Crew was that everybody was kind of outsiders in their own way. Yeah. And I often in life felt like a bit of an outsider in the playground. I always had a lot of friends, but, you know, I was the child of political exiles. My whole childhood, well, you know, up until kind of the age of 10, yeah, 11, we were trying to get our status sorted here. My parents were from South Africa. They were anti-apartheid activists.
Yeah.
I grew up in Oxford, very, very white.
Wow.
I'm obviously not. I had a very strong sense of my blackness and my Africanness. Mm-hmm. But obviously there was nobody to share that with. Yeah. And the way it came through was often like through music. A lot of the music that I liked, nobody else was interested in.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've always had the ability to mix. I'm very outgoing and had lots of friends, but it's interesting to hear how you viewed me in a group.
Yeah, yeah, but no, it's a compliment, but you just held your own. And in a way, you said, I had to get my shit together. It's like, you know, the way you just carry yourself and you're just quite, I don't know, just the way your whole conduct is really, really impressive. So, you know, I find that. So here's a compliment there. So
thank you.
Let's get into one of the first tracks because we've got quite a few to get through.
Yes.
Let's get to the first track and then we can talk about, you know, you coming into London, Oxford and when you first landed, really.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful track. That's Adili Yanyana, and that's Tembisa.
Yeah, so this is quite a recent track. It's by a guy called Adili Yanyana, who is a South African jazz musician. But it really reminds me of my dad. It reminds me of growing up. It reminds me of Sunday afternoons.
Lovely.
And Tembisa is a township in Johannesburg. My family's from Soweto, from a part of Soweto called Orlando East. But it just, even though I think it came out around in, somewhere
2002,
in the early 2000s. Yeah. I'm not going to pretend I know the exact date.
Yeah.
But it just really encapsulates for me that kind of, like kind of 60s jazz,
yeah,
that my dad used to listen to a lot. It just, and I remember, you know, he'd bring out all his records at the weekends and on Sundays. And it was like, you know, as I said, my parents were in political exile. When my dad left the country when he was in his early 20s. He never saw his parents again. So I don't know, like it was, there was this yearning for home and this kind of, when I hear this song and I hear like the riffs, it makes me think of sunshine. It makes me, and it also makes me think of now sitting in my dad's kitchen in his house now in Johannesburg. It's just very my dad.
Lovely.
Very kind of a real hark back to a certain kind of South African jazz, South African music,
mm-hmm.
An era as well when things were so difficult for Black people, but Black people would turn out, when I tell you in style, when I tell you like, those kind of Harlem pictures, that's how people would dress and, you know, the good, you know, the jazz halls and the good times that they managed to have.
Yep.
So it just reminds me of all of that. And I just thought it's very my childhood, very my dad.
Yeah. That's lovely. I want to touch on that, actually. You know, you're saying things are difficult for Black people. What was it like for you living with apartheid? And was it the same in rural or just outside the major cities as it was in the centre?
Well, we came here when I was two when we came over.
Wow,
so,
okay.
I mean, I grew up in Oxford, but what was ever present in my house was the political struggle.
Yeah.
And, the kind of brutality. I think my it was interesting for me recently when we had all of the discussions about racial justice and people wondering how to speak about it with their children, because my parents were really upfront with me, and obviously they would tell me in a child friendly way, but you know, the things that people were going through were real. I think the racism of apartheid was horrific. What was as horrific and isn't talked about so much is kind of the brutality of kind of broken families. You talk about the rural areas, the way that apartheid operated. It basically made it so that as a Black person, you didn't have the rights to, you know, you were kind of dumped in the worst bits of the country and you didn't have the rights to exist in other bits of your country.
Wow.
You didn't have the rights to own land in certain parts of the country. So yeah, I those were real things that people experienced.
Yeah.
And so I think, is it also interesting when I think of my parents, because they were so young.
Yeah.
And just like lots of people, they weren't alone in this.
Mm-hmm.
Just gave up everything to do what they could to make things different, to make things better.
Yeah. You know? And how was jazz, why is jazz so important or so influential in South Africa? Because it just affects so many areas of the country more than, I'm not saying indigenous music of any kind, but jazz seems to be very, very popular in South Africa.
I really have no idea. And that's something to ask my dad.
Yeah.
But I have to say there's a specific kind of South African jazz, like when I hear, like it's very identifiable.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also think that they're, something that also I find amazing is I think there's a resistance, like in having music and having a good time, dressing up. I think Black people all around the world, whether it's jazz, whether it's war, we've just found ways to find, even in the most difficult circumstances, find joy. We will find that joy.
Yeah. And how did your parents instill all these learnings and these feelings and pain and anguish and trauma not onto you, but how did you become so intrepid and driven? How did you not feel inferior and withdrawn? What were your survival skills? What do you think pushed you forward into your career trajectory?
Well, I think my parents, both of them, spent their lives doing something. And it wasn't just, you know, I think what I saw demonstrated in my household was that when something is wrong, you have to not just speak up, you have to do something about it.
Right.
So, you know, I would often have discussions with my mum, like about history, about what happened to Jewish people in the Second World War.
Right.
What happened, what has been happening. You know, politics was part of everyday discussions.
Yeah.
And it wasn't in the abstract. It was, and also we knew people that were doing stuff that, yeah, you know, everybody in our lives was doing something about what they believed in. Yeah. So
is politics really, obviously, an avid interest from you because you're doing great in your career. Was it something that your parents did that had a knock-on effect to you and you just ran with it? Or, you know, do you just love politics and for what it was?
Do you know what? I think that it is a bit like if you grow up in a church household.
Yeah.
Like, faith is going to be so much at the core of what you are.
Yeah.
And for me, I as I said, like for my parents were very, they were people who didn't just sit aside when things were wrong. And not just them, lots of people. I must stress that they weren't like alone in this.
Yeah.
People all across South Africa and also in exile who did the same thing. So I think I saw that, and I also saw they were always really hungry for news of what was happening all around the world.
Uh-huh.
So I think the idea that you have the luxury to disengage in things because you don't like them.
Yes, yes.
Well, there's somebody else going through that. So
agreed.
You know, I think that's what I saw demonstrated.
So you're 2 years old, slap bang into Oxford. Can you remember living in South Africa, or were you too young to remember that? Is that too?
Well, we didn't move. We didn't come to Oxford straight away.
Okay.
We lived in London for a bit, and uh-huh, then we moved to Oxford. Obviously, I was very little, but I there's little faint memories I have from like my grandparents' house.
Brilliant.
But we went back when I was about 7 years old. I was smuggled across the border, the South African border, to see my grandparents and to spend time with my family.
How did you get across? So the logistics, did you fly?
We'd gone to Botswana with my mum.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was driven across the border.
Wow.
On somebody else's passport to see my grandparents.
Amazing.
But I mean, my parents were wanted by the police. So if they would have caught us, if I'd have been caught, I would not have been able to come back in order to make my mum come back. So it was quite a high risk.
Okay.
But I think my mum felt, both of my parents, my family felt, you know, that's what people did. You know, that's what we do as Black people, that,
yeah,
you know, your family's important.
Yeah.
You do when you can,
yeah,
what you can, you know.
Wow. Okay. So did you actually go back once you obviously had your formative years education in England? Did you go back to study as a result of that, and could you do that safely?
Yeah, so the first democratic elections, 94, was when I was in the middle of my A-levels. So basically, my first years of uni, I decided to go back. But so the democratic change had happened, Nelson Mandela was president.
Right.
So I went back, and my mum had moved back by then. So I went back and did my undergrad there at Wits University. So that's how I ended
up. What was that like? You know, you're going back to a country where you're born, but your formative years, you know, your teenage years were in England. What was it like to adapt? Was there a huge transition for you?
I think it was a really interesting experience. And I think that one of the things that my time living in South Africa really gave me, that was a real gift, was to be somewhere where you're in the majority.
Yeah.
And to be somewhere where there are so many different models is the wrong word, but you see Black people doing so many different things.
Mm-hmm.
You see Black people trying, succeeding, making business, just all around you, people are doing different. Well, here, I think if you're successful, that you're like, it sometimes feels like we're pigeonholed into certain areas, like the images of success.
Sure.
And it's very different from when you go to, like, you know, when you go home and all around you, there's so many different models of success and actually trying and failing as an option. Like, I think that in the West, often as a Black person, failure is just not an option. Yeah. Whereas when you're back home, you can try a thing, and if it doesn't work out, you try something else.
Well, really interesting questions that are ruminating in my head, actually. First one is, you could speak language anyway. Did your parents teach you that in England?
I can understand. I could. I think if I got over my shyness, I probably could speak. When I do speak, my family, my home language is Setswana.
Okay.
When I do speak, my aunt says it's decent, but other times people have laughed at me. So take that as you will. But I can understand my.
Yeah.
Is another matter.
And what was the I guess some people coming out of apartheid might have been still stunned or in inertia or not doing anything. Or did everybody capitalize on the opportunity, and was everybody opportunistic, or were some people reticent, or what was the general mood of people? Was everybody, let's go do it, or, you know?
I don't know. I don't know quite how to answer that, because I think that, you know, you obviously have a podcast that you would like to complete. I think that the discussion around economic transformation is quite a long one and quite a difficult one.
Yeah.
What I would say about that period was there was an incredible excitement, and this was a new country. And also, like, I can't stress enough, like, for all the challenges and you know, ups and downs that South Africa may experience now, prior to 94, you, by law, were not an equal human being. So to have that demarcation, like, actually, by law, you have rights. And there, you can argue about whether the hopes and dreams turned out to be what people had hoped. But at that time, that was something very exciting, and that is something significant.
Brilliant. Okay, well, let's get into your next track, and then we'll talk about university and your career, and let's get into that good stuff. Your tender smile gives me half the thoughts of you. Hey, babe, you got me so close to my dreams, now they have to come true. Oh, baby, nothing to be shy about, nothing we have to lie about. Hope loving you don't confuse you. talk to me at that track. So, guys, listeners, you don't know what's been going on. We've been finger snapping, hand clapping.
So I chose that song for lots of reasons. It's funny, I was out with a good friend of mine yesterday, and I was talking, saying that I was going to be doing this. Uh-huh. And she said, I said, okay, guess what songs? She said there must be Aretha Franklin on there.
Of course.
Now, the reason I chose that was because it's from the Sparkle album. My dad had that album in the plastic. It still had the plastic. You could not...
Cellophane, of course.
Yeah, you couldn't, like, you know, I wasn't even allowed to touch the needle on the thing, touch the records.
No, so, sacred.
Yeah, yeah. So I remember that album. I remember the record player. And I remember my parents would dance to it. And my mum, especially, I just remember her, like, dancing. And sometimes you'd catch them dancing together. It reminds me also of, like, you know, parties when adults just, they go around. You know how black people, you just end up at a gathering, then it goes on all night night. So it reminds me of those kind of things. It reminds me of my dad. My dad was it's funny because he's not a musician, but he had a lot to say about where people should sing from. And it's funny because I was having this conversation again with somebody else the other day. He was the one that taught me, you know, when you use your voice, use your diaphragm. Don't, you know, his pet hate is people that, like, sing out of here. Or if you're going to sing, use your head voice, do it for a reason. That's something that's really helpful in broadcasting, obviously, like vocal control and that kind of stuff. But I just remember, like, for him, all these soul singers with these incredible big voices know, he had his, my mum and dad have very interesting music taste. They're both, they both have amazing music tastes that really shaped me. My dad is much more jazz and soul. Although he started to like a bit of like Kenny G music, which I'm not that into. But my mum...
Songbird wasn't a bad track.
My mum has very eclectic taste. So she's... And she's like a musical encyclopedia. So classical, opera, all this old soul. She'll even tell you, she'll tell me new artists that I should look out for. I remember being in Oxford Street with her one time by Oxford Circus, and then she just disappeared. And she was, I was like, then I found her and she was dancing. There was someone, you know, when those people dancing, and someone's playing Fish Go Deep, you know, that Don't Take Your Love. So she was there getting down, dancing to that. So my mum has very, very current, very classical, very, you know, Sarah Vaughan, everything. Sarah Vaughan to like rap, she'll listen to.
Brilliant. So, I love that track and I haven't heard it for ages. And that's produced by Curtis Mayfield as well.
Oh, yeah, my dad loved Curtis Mayfield.
So he's amazing. So he had the passionate bit, but he had the smooth. It's like he poured Lenore of the track and just smoothed it all out. It's just like nice, you know.
So it just reminds me of good times. It reminds me of joy. It reminds me of, and like I said, that thing of like, we'll find the joy. But my friend also said, I asked her, oh, why did you say Aretha? And she said, because I also love gospel music, but I'll come to that a bit later. But I find that it touches me in a place and in a way that no other music can.
It's a tearjerker, isn't it, Queen. Sometimes as well, for me.
Yeah, and like a massage for your heart. You know?
Wow. So, So going to university, what was that like? You're leaving home, culturally, adventure, you're developing as a person. What was that like? Yeah, obviously you were studious in your past. Did you have fun? Did you enjoy it? What was that like going to university for that period of time in a new country?
I studied politics and international relations, which I really enjoyed and have really, really helped me now. And I think it was a real blessing to study them in an African country. So you've got a different perspective, like an Afrocentric view on geopolitics, which is
So it wasn't just about African politics per se, it was about geopolitics, but from an African perspective.
So international relations obviously is, you know, encompasses geopolitics. It's about how, it's about power and how states relate to each other and who runs the world, basically. But I found it really interesting and it's been very useful to have studied that from an African perspective.
Now, did you do everything in English? Was everything taught in English 100%?
Yeah. So everything except my one African language module that I did.
Which was your native language?
It was Sesotho, which is very similar to Setswana. So,
Okay, well, look, we've got a lot of tracks to get through because we've got 9 tracks to get through today. As opposed to the staple. But, you know, Lebu, do your thing. Let's move to the next track and see what that is.
Another reason I chose the Aretha track was because there was an En Vogue. En Vogue did a version of that, Hooked on Your Love.
Okay.
And that album, do you remember I told you that, you know, growing up in Oxford, I had lots of friends, but I also was a bit of an outsider. So a lot of the music I liked, nobody else liked.
Right.
And that album, I was obsessed with the En Vogue album. For me, they were these beautiful women. They had that old school, but they were new as well, and they were a bit hip-hop-y as well. And I remember a friend saying to me, I knew you'd like that because you like that music.
Was that a compliment?
I don't know what it was, but it's just interesting to me that it was just quite clear that I kind of did my own thing. So that was another reason. So it was that version and I didn't know which one to choose, but that was why I chose that song too.
No, that's cool. That's cool. So in terms of the Whitney Houston track now, talk to me about why that, How Will I Know?
So I think there's a couple of artists that I think it is impossible to understand me without understanding my love for those people and why. And Whitney Houston is one of those artists. I loved her so much. Me and my friend at school were obsessed with her. And my friend has a book. We were about 9 years old.
Yeah.
So we did like class projects together and stuff. My friend still got one of our workbooks together where we were set an assignment to write like a letter to someone important, whatever. So wrote a letter to Whitney Houston saying, could she come around to tea, whatever. That was our assignment. Very creative writing. And the teacher wrote, that's not very realistic, is it?
Creative writing, not very realistic. Okay.
But I loved her. I even remember her and also Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
I went to quite a lot of trouble recording my own kind of karaoke versions of their songs and sending them to them, taping them and sending them to them. I got the addresses from the back of their tapes, because I had the tapes. So what we had, so I remember we had 2 tape things. So I would play their things on one, and then I would tape on the other.
Look,
then I would sing. I must have been like 9 ish around that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I did this for Michael Jackson and I did this for Whitney Houston. So the letter to Michael Jackson, I was like, you know, child prodigy to child prodigy. Like,
do
you
it.
Know,
yeah, yeah.
I would like, I feel that we should meet. And then
I feel that we should meet.
Yes, I'd love you to come over.
Fine.
Come, let's, you know, I love you. And also child prodigy, like, yeah, you know.
You're telling Michael Jackson that you were a child prodigy.
I like, didn't say prodigy, but I was just like, you know, child star to like potential child star.
Fine.
And then Whitney Houston.
Nice.
It was just like, I love you so much. You're so beautiful. And again, you know, just come round for tea. Like, we've got food. You would love it.
As you
here.
Do.
You just would love it. And then I taped these things of me singing for them. So I sent them these things and I don't know, I don't even know where I got the money for the stamps from, the envelopes from. I don't know where I got that money. But I also didn't know that my mum knew. I only found out she knew because after about, I don't know how long it was, like 2-3 weeks, she just was like, and I just would run to the post every day, like expecting them to write, fully expecting that they'd write back. Fully.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh.
Expecting that they'd write back. And my mum just really tried to let me down gently and be like, you know, they get a lot of letters. I don't know if she knew what was, I don't know if I've never asked her. I don't know why I've never asked her whether she knew that I'd made a tape, or made tapes for them of my amazing singing skills.
I'm sure she heard you doing, you know, quite.
No, I think. Well, she might not have been in. Like, maybe my dad was there. Like, my dad, I don't know. Like, it's easy to do stuff when someone's in another bit of the house.
Yeah.
I don't know. I say that. I probably didn't know. But you know, when you're a child and you just think you're so slick. So I don't know if she knew that I'd sent them a tape or if she just thought it was like a general letter. Hey.
What I like is the research and the due diligence you did. You know, it looked on the back of the tape.
Yeah, yeah. To their record company.
To the record company.
Yeah. And I think that that's a real product of my childhood, actually, because my parents, as I said, were fairly young, early 20s, and I'm an only child.
Yeah.
And my parents and their friends, very political. Mm-hmm. So they would always talk to me like I was a adult. So they would ask me my opinions. They would ask me what my thoughts were about what was happening in the world.
Yep.
And their friends would ask me. And I think debating is a sport in South Africa, but also like just growing up in the family that I did, those are the kind of discussions that we had all the time. So I think that even though I'm not always confident in every area of my life, mm-hmm. I did grow up thinking I had a voice that I was worth listening to because my parents did listen to my opinion and my thoughts, and my thoughts were entertained and engaged with by adults. Yeah, Whitney Houston.
Do you think that was the early burgeoning confidence and that you got into becoming a correspondent, you know, being listened to, be able to articulate your views for early age?
I think it did teach me to articulate myself and to be able to put together like an argument is the wrong word, but like, you know, build a case, build a train of thought. And I think that the media industry, like lots of creative industries, is not a meritocracy. It's not like sales or like, you know, working in the city where it's the numbers. There's a lot that can make you not confident. But I think that the one gift that my parents gave me is that I do, even though there's lots of areas where, like all of us, I might not be as confident, I do think that what I have to say is worth listening
to. Good for you. Good for you. So in terms of...
No more or no less than other people, I would say, but, you know.
Yeah, no, it's good to have a voice. It's good to be expressed. I'm thinking, so what was that like? Because how did you want to do that, even in Oxford, where there's a lot of people that didn't look like you, and then you went to university where everybody looked like you, if you know what I mean, there are more black people there. Did that complete you in terms of your identity a bit more?
Yeah, I do. I do think that that was very, very important. I think that, I think that there was something magic about that, actually. There was something magic about being... just in every aspect desirable. Yeah. Like, so I'm not just talking about like as a, you know, young university student or whatever. I'm talking about, you know, as a young, you're the future of this country. Your thoughts, your energy, your being is something that is desired, and desired and wanted. And there are lots of other people like you that are the same.
Do you know what? When I first went to Africa, I went to, I think it was, did I go to Gambia or Kenya for the first time? And it was so amazing just being the majority. I've never felt that before in my life. It was like, everywhere you turn, this black was like, oh, there wasn't a black area. It was just a whole continent. You felt completely surrounded.
Very validating.
Very validating. And one thing I noticed, and it's a small thing in life, I was staying in a hotel first place. And you know, you go into and you get the little toothpaste and bits and bobs. There was an Afrocomb in there.
Yeah.
I know it's small, but there was an Afrocomb in there. I was like,
but it's
my
a big
God.
Thing, right?
That is a big thing. Like, there was, you know, the majority was an Afrocomb, not a Caucasian comb, but there's an Afrocomb. So I just felt, it seemed really minor, but to me, that made me feel like really like, oh, okay, I'm in a place where I'm not, I'm in the majority.
You're tolerated. Yes. You're wanted. You're
accepted.
And your looks being are the blueprint.
Yes.
Rather than the thing we have to adjust for.
Yeah. But it took me a while to adjust to that. It took me a while just to get around it. You know, I didn't acclimate. It took me about, I don't know, a couple of days. But it was like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
So you've done university. Let's fast forward to you being a correspondent, okay? This is really, really exciting. What was that like? What was your first, when you got to BBC 2003? Were you wowed? Was it like, was it quite nervous? Because was there a lot of pressure on you? Because you might have been quite, you know, one of the very few black female correspondents there.
Oh, but I didn't start as a correspondent. I started working in reception.
I started
working in reception in the political unit. Basically, I'm trying to like shrink this story down because it's quite long and boring. But basically, I did a postgrad in broadcast journalism. And one of the things that you're kind of expected to do to get into media is to work for a few years with very little or no money. I had no family here. All my family were in South Africa.
Right.
I had no one to live with. You know, I had bills to pay. So I went into like sales for 2 years.
Yeah.
It was hell. It was, I hated it so much. And for me, the idea of like, it was just the wrong fit for me. Now, those skills that I learned in sales have been incredibly useful in my job now, actually. But at the time, the idea of not doing what my heart wanted to do was really painful. So I'd been applying, trying to get in, didn't like, you know, I never was successful getting on any kind of traineeship schemes or anything like that.
Yep.
So how I got that job on reception, I'd applied for a job and did not get it. And the man said to me, well, we quite often have space for freelancers here just to come and do bits and bobs. I mean, it was an entry level job.
Yep.
So if you're interested, let me know. And I just basically was so desperate. I remember I'd left my sales job, had no money. Mm-hmm. It was just like, it was do or die, make or break.
Yeah.
And I just phoned him every day. And then he said, come in. But that guy, Tim Finch, and I will give him a shout out because Tim was a white guy. And he said that, so where he worked was that bit of the BBC's opposite Parliament. He said he was aware that basically this entry level job was kind of a gateway to so many other opportunities. Cause once you have nobody really is going to answer the email that comes from a Gmail account. But once you have a BBC address, it makes it so much easier to put yourself in front of people. And everybody that had ever got that job was the niece or nephew of somebody that was already in the newsroom.
So there's a lot of nepotism going on there.
Not nepotism, but just we give opportunities to people like us.
Right.
And he was very clear that he wanted to give opportunities to people not like him. And he was very deliberate about that and intentional about it.
Impressive.
And I think there was an onus on us to chase that opportunity. But I mean, he said, look, you're only here like a couple of shifts a week. So the rest of the time, I would advise you to use that BBC email address, send out your CV, get as many shifts in other places as you possibly can. So I've had quite a long and winding road through the BBC and it's not been a linear career. Yeah. And I don't know that there's very many people that just arrive day one and they're correspondent.
Did you do a bit of, was it CNN or other stations?
I left the BBC for a while and I went and did freelance. When I was freelancing, one of the people I did some freelance work for was, you know, I did a few pieces for CNN.
Yeah.
But I spent maybe sort of 6 years at the BBC, left and then came back. And that, again, was really helpful in that I got an opportunity to do. If I hadn't done that, I would never have done foreign news.
Right.
And I love foreign news. I love, well, I say foreign, but I love, that's what it's called,
yes,
here.
Yes.
But I love news about places in the world that have people that, you know, look like me in the majority, or places, you know, I spent the last year I spent in America. That's somewhere that's very different. It's not like, you know, part of the global south.
Yeah.
But again, for other reasons, it's really, really fascinating. I think the world is big and I'm very, that's what excites me, like how other people live, their experiences and all that jazz.
Well, we'll play the next track. We need to get back to your exploits in America recently. Okay. I found it really, really interesting. When I first heard Biggie's voice, so we're laughing here, we're having a good old dance here, which is brilliant. When I first heard Biggie's voice and he started rapping, he just like pulled my head off. Like, who is this guy?
He's amazing. Really? Yeah, oh, I thought you liked him in a good way.
In a good way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, it blew my mind. Yeah. Like, you know,
that Ready to Die album is still one of my favourite albums of all time. I love it.
Yeah. Why is this song especially for you then, while we're talking about America?
Well, it's not so much... Well, the song is about is an era. So that song is an era of my life. It really reminds me of university, actually. Like, it was before I went to university. It was at school. But Mary... Mary's the other artist where you cannot... If you don't know... My love for Mary J. Blige. If you don't know what this woman means to me, you don't fully know me. And I chose that song because it reminded me of an era and Biggie, and you know the fact just everything about it is a vibe, and it reminds what it led on to. But actually, I was torn because I wanted to use "You're All I Need to Get By," but the one that was on Meth's album, not the more grimy version. But yeah, I love Mary and that era of R&B, hip hop, soul. Yeah.
And I like the way she conducted herself in the way that, because she was in it. She was in hip-hop soul as well. That's quite male-dominated. Yeah. And she still managed to hold her own and get onto tracks and sing on rap songs, but also have features on there, but not feel swamped by the hyper-masculinity that rap can be sometimes as well.
Yeah, exactly. So I love Mary. I couldn't do the songs of my life without Mary. And that's just an era, a whole era for me.
Well, speaking of that in America, this is a segue into this. I just want to talk about you being a correspondent for America. And one of the things I want to talk about that is, you know, you were in one of the Capitol buildings while all the excitement was going on. And were you actually locked in at that point?
Yeah, that was an interesting day.
So peeps, I believe we've got to leave it there. Please like and subscribe on your chosen platform to check out part two of this interview. In the meantime, please stay well. My name is Mr. Pierre, and you've been listening to Fortified 45s. Five, 45, 45, 45.